The Senate Transportation Committee will come to order. Due to budget cuts, we don't have a gavel anymore, so we'll have to do without it. Today we're here to discuss two issues. One is with Mr. Dorgan and his folks. And this is the kind of the same portion of information on our bridge program that was unfolded to the House committee, and that's been a couple or three weeks ago now. So we'll talk to Mr. Dorgan about that. And then we have some things from DVS, and Ms. McCormick is here on their behalf, and we'll move right into that. But first, Mr. Dorgan, if and if you just allow me just a second here to make a couple comments. First, with the NTSB report coming in, you know, we have a very clear understanding of the 35W bridge collapse. I just want to make sure that the public and the folks in the bridge office and the folks of this committee at least know where I'm at on the NTSB report. I believe that it was a very well-crafted document, and it leads us to several conclusions. One is we know exactly the reason why the gusset plate failed. Caused the bridge to collapse. And going through those through that document, it's also very apparent that they make recommendations as to what bridge departments should be looking for in the future. And I know that Mr. Dorgan and all his folks have read that material and are coming up with ideas as we speak on how to improve our bridge program. And contrary to some of the things that have been said in the past, I do believe very strongly that our bridge program is one of the best in the United States. And I say that for a couple of reasons, not just to, for Mr. Dorgan's benefit, but I say that in knowing what our bridge program is and then studying and talking with legislators from other states and seeing what kind of bridge programs they have. They still hold Minnesota up as a gold standard, and that's good to know. I think that some of the changes that Mr. Dorgan and his outfit are going to be proposing and have implemented already is a very good start in making sure that not only the bridges are safe in Minnesota, but the bridges across this country are safe, because there's a lot of bridge folks that are looking at Minnesota to see what we do. With that, Mr. Dorgan, I would hope that in the future that any controversy that may arise, that we can nip it in the bud in a hurry, because I think this is one thing that people need to understand, that in Minnesota we do things for the most part according to the book and according to the letter of the law. And I do believe that our police department is one of the best in the United States, and we're going to continue to grow, make changes, and make it even better. With that, Mr. Dorgan, please, your presentation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm Dan Dorgan, the bridge engineer with MnDOT, for those that I may have not met. Dwayne, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Dwayne Hill, and I work for MnDOT up in Duluth, District 1. I'm the maintenance engineer there, and I'm here along with Dan because when the bridge collapsed, he asked me to help manage the governor's bridge inspection initiative.
Thank you. And just for the committee members and the folks in the room, Jenny Morris is with us now as our LA. And so welcome aboard, Jenny, and Mr. Dorr.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for those opening comments. And we certainly share that goal of making what we feel is a good program, continue to keep it in the forefront nationwide and make it the best it can be. So, and it's just want to let everybody know it's far more than myself. We've got many people statewide working on bridge inspection, and they're very conscientious and do a very, I think, a very excellent job. The material we'd like to run through today is to provide you an update on bridge inspections and what's been occurring in the last year and a half in that arena. I'm going to, and Duane and I will be sharing this presentation, but our purpose is to first of all just give you a brief overview of inspection requirements. Most of those you are familiar with, so we won't spend a lot of time on that, because I think we want to spend more time on the actions that have been taken in the last year in the inspection area. And these actions reflect items we have identified ourselves as we've taken a real critical look, I think, not only our inspection, our maintenance, our design end of the business, because I think given the tragedy that happened on 35W, that was a natural reaction that we look at all aspects of our program. So these actions have been either identified by ourselves, at times they were opportunities noted by the legislative auditor. There was also the joint committee report to the House and Senate that was performed by Gray Plant Moody, and also a process review of our inspection program by PB Americas. So these all stem from then multiple efforts. And we're glad to share this information. We've got quite a bit of information to go through, so hopefully as we cover that, maybe we'll answer some of your questions that you may have had in mind as you came today. If we use a term that's unfamiliar, please stop us. We are engineers. We know we at times use a term that may leave you baffled, so please stop us so we can explain that. And also, certainly, we'll stay to answer whatever questions we can. With that, then, there's been a handout that should be in your packet, so that's the PowerPoint we'll be going through today. The first photo shows a slide of several of our inspection staff that work throughout the state conducting inspections. As I mentioned, I'd like to begin with just a brief overview of our inspection requirements and then those actions taken in the last year. And for the overview of inspection requirements, I just refer you to pages, I think it begins on page 27 of your handout, is a summary of inspection regulations, just starting on page 27, and this is mainly a quick refresher for you. The various inspection requirements that we adhere to stem from beginning with the National Bridge Inspection Standards that are set by federal regulations. Those are also go hand in hand with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, the manuals they publish. This is the AASHTO group that represents the 50 states nationwide. And then our own statutes, which you're probably well familiar with, not only statute but rules cover inspection requirements, along with technical memorandums that that we publish for our counties and for our own inspection staff. Inspection frequency then is covered by the NBIS, the National Bridge Inspection System. Every state's required to inspect their bridges at least once every 24 months. In Minnesota, we have long had a higher standard than that. If the condition of the bridge is rated as a 4 or less for the superstructure, substructure, or deck, then we inspect those bridges routinely on an annual basis. And in addition to those routine inspections, then there's a number of other inspections. Fracture-critical bridges receive the additional fracture-critical inspection at least once every 24 months, and then there are also underwater inspections that are required by NBIS. And again, this is real, just going over this real quick, because I believe some of this is information you're well familiar with. Bridge inspector qualifications then, within MnDOT, we have 75 certified team leaders that meet both the state and the federal requirements to be a certified team leader. Mm-hmm. And all inspections must be conducted with a team leader on site in charge of that inspection. To become a team leader, you either have to be a professional engineer or 5 years' experience in performing inspections, and then also in either case, you have to have completed the Federal Highways an approved course from FHWA on inspection. Within Minnesota, we add the additional requirement of a proficiency exam where you actually go out in the field and after the class and perform an inspection, and that's graded. And then we have the requirement of attending what amounts to continuing education, two courses every 4 years on inspection. So I realize that that's been fairly quick, but again, I think the focus today, if we understand it correctly, was probably of interest of what we've been doing in the last year or so. So with that, I'll go back to slide 4. And the first thing I'd like to address is our gusset plate reviews and inspections. And this effort directly addresses one of the findings of the National Transportation Safety Board regarding the I-35 bridge. In January, they put out information that gusset plates were the focus and a design error in the gusset plates for I-35. At that time, there was really no software or rating methods available for checking gussets. Because of our involvement in the investigation, this was we were aware of this upcoming finding, so we began work last October developing our process to review gusset plates, and actually had already begun on that effort at the time it was announced nationally in January for all states to begin conducting these reviews. The photo on the right side actually is of the Hastings Bridge, and the piece of steel that's shown just above the chains that's of a little different color is an additional brace that we installed between gusset plates on that bridge in May, and that was one of the results of our review on the Hastings Bridge. We decided to inspect all, to go through a rating of all 25 of our truss bridges within the state highway system. So in those cases, it was really a three-step process. We did engineering reviews of the load rating, went entirely through the truss, including the gusset plates, and rated the load capacity. We also did field inspections to discern if any of those gussets had any corrosion, loss of section that would affect the ratings. So that was all considered as the ratings were performed. And those two efforts were completed in July and August of 2008. We had all the engineering work done in July and also the field work done by August. And our effort for those 25 bridges was to determine if there was any design deficiencies or issues similar to I-35W. Of our 25 trusses, we found that all were designed correctly originally. There was no design deficiencies similar to I-35. The photo on the right is the Wabasha Bridge at Wabasha, Minnesota, over the Mississippi, one of those 25 bridges we would have reviewed. But we did have other findings, and I'm sure you kind of recall some of what transpired earlier in the year. The St. Cloud Bridge, as part of that effort, was closed, and the replacement was accelerated, and that's underway as we speak, the replacement of the St. Cloud Bridge. The Blatnick Bridge in Duluth, and that's actually the photo on this slide, we found some gusset plates there that needed to be stiffened to restore the full safety factor to what it was originally in the design. And two things occurred on the Blatnick Bridge. In the early 90s, a overlay was added to it, which increased the weight on that bridge, and there had also been some corrosion that had occurred prior to the painting in the early 90s. That had reduced capacity slightly. So the just if it's of interest to you on Blatnick, as you look at that photo, just to the right of those ropes, you'll see some new pieces of steel that are on the face of that gusset. Those are stiffening the gusset in to prevent it from buckling in those areas. And so that additional steel was needed again to get the full safety factor that we desire in these. So I just want to make it clear this was not an issue anywhere near to the levels of 35W. It was a matter of getting the full safety factor out of the that we should have in a bridge design. So traffic was restricted to two lanes while we made those repairs. So those were completed in June, I believe. Was it July? July. Okay. We completed those repairs in July. And again, these actions kind of directly stem from learnings from NTSB. What may be of interest, if you're able to look closely at your photo, you'll be able to see some markings with numbers behind them. Those are measurements of thickness of the gusset plates using ultrasonic testing devices that our inspectors used to test in areas where they could not visually see from the backside because too many steel members were interconnecting behind there. That was another outcome that was cited by NTSB in their eventual recommendations to utilize technology.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a question, if I may.
Senator Olstein.
You know, when I look at that, you know, that's pretty heavy steel, and yet those reinforcement plates, you know, look like some angle iron and some channel. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised you're not, like, putting a half-inch overlay or something on there. Why are they such, you know, doesn't seem like real heavy fix for.
Okay.
Mr. Doran.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olstein, what's happening there, if you look at the photo, there's a member coming in from the lower right and also another diagonal member coming from the lower left. The one on the lower right is what we call a compression member, so that's pushing on this whole connection. And the concern there is from the end of the bolt pattern, there is a small area that is, you can actually see this over on the other side. If you look at the diagonal from the left, the bolts end, and then there's some plate with no bolts perforating it, kind of an area just above there. That's a tension side, so we're not concerned about buckling there. But on the right-hand side, we are concerned that pushing would buckle the plate. So this is a stiffener. I guess I would compare it to putting a splint on your leg if you had injured your leg or broken it, and you just need some additional strength in there to carry the load. And so this is very effective over a short distance. It fully stiffens it. So I can assure you these have been looked over very carefully. So it does not take much to stiffen against buckling, but it's important to have it there.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dorgan, on the, you know, there are those angles that are in the longer areas. Were those to meet a standard? Because there was a spec that evidently the 35W bridge didn't meet as far as the unsupported edge. And is this to meet that standard, or was there a particular problem found in buckling in this area? And I guess I want to ask about that buckling area above the diagonal that comes in from the right. Was that something that you found from finite element analysis, or was there some thought that this was actually a maybe a deteriorated member?
Okay. Senator Carlson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there were several questions in there. First of all, maybe I'll deal with the compression member coming in, the plates added. There was two things, again, happening: the added weight from the early 90s and then some corrosion in that area that had reduced the capacity and the strength to handle the buckling. And again, this is pushing, so if you can think of a piece of cardboard folding it, that's what the thrust is attempting to do there. A finite element analysis was not needed. A regular analysis was sufficient to determine the capacity and this fix in that area. So that was conducted, and it's based on the engineering review of the plans, the added weight, plus the field information from the inspectors. So I hope that addresses, Senator Carlson, mm-hmm. your question on these added members. I think on the angles, you're probably referring to the four angles around the perimeter of that
Correct.
Plate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what you're asking. There was a code requirement for stiffening the edge of the gusset, and that was not met in these. And we're finding that was that was not uncommon back in those years. Apparently, for the 1960s, that were uncertain as to what the thinking was at the time, but they did not all meet the requirements for that unstiffened edge. So those angles were added for
okay.
that reason, and that was similar on the Hastings Bridge, that earlier photo.
Okay.
So I think those are probably more precautionary. We decided as long as we're going to this effort, we'd stiffen them and bring them fully up to code.
Mm-hmm.
Two other bridges then were repaired as a result of those efforts. The Winona Bridge, there we had corrosion in a gusset, and so we had a contract, and that was completed mid-July to address those issues on Winona, and then the Hastings Bridge that I mentioned earlier. So in summary then of those gusset plate efforts, we did confirm that the original designs were correct, but our field reviews and along with our engineering analysis required actions on those four bridges. So those have been done, and I'd also like to say the counties, by the way, there is a contract and county trusses are being looked at also.
Mm-hmm.
Through our state aid area, there is efforts going on to go through those similar reviews on the county system. So this, and Mr. Chairman, I hope that kind of addresses, this points to one thing that's a direct relation to that NTSB results. In the areas of inspection then, another effort in the last year and a half, and this was cited in the legislative auditor's report, and I'm on page 7 of the handout, by the way. The Office of the Legislative Auditor recommended that MnDOT provide additional funds to increase our fracture critical inspection staff. So we've established 8 additional positions. 6 of those are within the bridge office, within our fracture critical inspection unit, and then 1 in each within Rochester and within Metro. So we have so far filled 3 of the 6 in the bridge office. Rochester, I just found out this morning, has filled their inspection engineer position, and Metro is in the process of advertising, or posting rather, for their position. So those are not all filled, but we are staffing up in that fracture critical area. Now with that, I'd like to turn it over to Duane, who was very active and great assistance to us last year. And I should also mention, Duane is a certified team leader, so he has great background in conducting inspections and also has the district maintenance and inspection background. So he's been a great asset to us, helping us over the last year. Go ahead, Duane.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, well, so the first thing Dan wants me to talk about is the governor's inspection program. And after the collapse, the governor said we need to go inspect all of our bridges in Minnesota. So we had to figure out exactly what that meant, and we kind of summed it up as shown on slide 8 here. The thing that's missing is the first thing that we did was we inspected all the deck truss bridges that we have. I think there was 5 of them in Minnesota, which are the same structure type as the 35W bridge, and those were done within a couple of days of that bridge collapse to ensure that there wasn't some systematic problem with deck truss bridges. But then in addition to that, trying to interpret what the governor wanted, it was priority order, inspect all the bridges. Well, within MnDOT, we have the ability with our own resources to inspect the trunk highway bridges. And then because of the way the inspection cycles are required, we were able to ensure that the counties and cities inspected all of the structurally deficient bridges on their systems. So by priority order, we made sure we got in-depth fracture critical inspections done on all the local and trunk highway fracture critical bridges. We did a routine inspection on all the local and trunk highway structurally deficient bridges, either with consultants, MnDOT forces, or the county and city inspectors. And then lastly, we ensured that we had a routine inspection done on every one of our trunk highway bridges that are not structurally deficient, so the remaining number of trunk highway bridges. And then lastly, the governor asked us to have an independent stem-to-stern review of our bridge inspection program. So we had a consultant perform that review. Let's see here. So part of my job was to do a daily update. What's our progress? So we kept a score every day. How many bridges have we got inspected? How many do we have left to do? And our goal was to have it done by December 1st, but between weather and it was a big task. December 20th was when I could finally say we had all of our goal met. And we had 3,875 routine and fracture critical inspections completed on the trunk highway system. Of those, 270 were done by consultants. And on the local system, we had 141 fracture critical inspections completed. 43 of those were done by consultants. The remainder were done by the bridge office staff that does fracture critical inspections, and the staff from Rochester and the staff from the Metro District. And then additionally, there were 843 structurally deficient bridge inspections completed, and those are the ones on the local system.
Mr. Hill, we find many problems on the local system. I know that speaking with local officials, they were in the office this morning talking about, you know, the need for local road and bridge fund to be kind of filled up a little bit in the next bonding cycle.
Okay. Well, one of the things I knew that as we were doing this, how do we explain what we found with this inspection program? And what I'm going to talk about on slide 10 is kind of the big results of the inspection program. We have a process called critical finding process where any inspector in the state, if they find something that could compromise the structural integrity of the bridge and could lead to a collapse, is expected to report that immediately to the bridge office. And that starts a chain of reaction that ensures follow-up in dealing with that issue. And during that process, we had 17 critical findings. Of those critical findings, most of them were on the local system. So we broke down those critical findings here. Of those, there were six bridges that were closed, all on the local system. Six bridges had load or lane restrictions. And an example would be, I don't have a specific one on the top of my mind, but I'm thinking of a very low load-posted bridge that we found issues with, and the county engineer was concerned that there were still commercial vehicles using the bridge, so we worked with the county engineer to install a height restrictor on that bridge to ensure that these taller vehicles couldn't use it. We had a number of those, and then we additionally had five bridges that were repaired, and included in those were two on the trunk highway system. In August, we found the Highway 11 bridge over the Red River at Drayton, North Dakota, and Robin, Minnesota, way up in northwestern Minnesota, had an issue with it was a redundant component, but it was a crack in the steel member. And we had to close the road and do some repairs on that member, provide some additional support underneath it, and before we could open it back up. And that bridge is currently being planned for replacement. And then also we found a ramp off of Highway 10 near Little Falls that had been struck by a high load, and a crack was shown or found during an inspection process in one of the beams. And we ended up grinding out that crack to make sure the defect wouldn't propagate any further in that beam. So hopefully that answers your question about findings. And that's kind of the worst of the work of what we found, or a summary of the worst. There's a significant number of local structurally deficient bridges that we inspected, so there's certainly a significant need.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hill, when you talked about you ground out the crack, you ground it out to make sure that there was no corrosion or anything in the crack. Did you have it re-welded, or was there a way that you keep the crack from continuing to crack?
The grinding process is intended to get to the end of the damage so the crack doesn't propagate further into the metal. And then we use our ultrasonic testing equipment to ensure we've got no more defect in the metal. Mm-hmm. And we know the location, so during our normal inspection cycle, we'll keep checking that location.
So if you've got that, just say a quarter-inch crack, then you would grind out half-inch and then go back in and test and make sure that you got to the end of the crack?
Correct.
Okay.
You can also drill. I think this crack must have been in the edge of the plate. That's why we're grinding. If you find a crack in the middle of a plate, you can drill out the ends of the crack to arrest it and stop it. So that's another common repair.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Next thing I wanted to talk about is the...
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, you don't add any more material or weld the crack up or anything, just grind it out and stop it, and that's sufficient to maintain the strength?
Mm-hmm. In this case, it was sufficient. I think if this was a nick in the corner of a beam from a high load hit, if it was a corrosion issue or something, a different type of issue, you might add steel. But in this case, that was a sufficient repair.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, and Senator, we have at times, if you get a full-depth crack in a plate, then we have plated over. Lafayette Bridge 30 years ago had a significant crack. That was plated over. So it's all kind of dependent on where the crack is, how much it has propagated.
Thank you.
Right. The PB Americas process review was the consultant that we hired to do the stem to stern review that the governor wanted of our bridge inspection program. And I guess part of the findings were to define what we asked them to do. And we asked PB to look at our bridge inspection program with respect to the National Bridge Inspection Standards in the Code of Federal Regulations and what a bridge inspection program is supposed to be all about. And there's five key areas in that bridge inspection program that they looked at. And those were the organization of our bridge inspection program that has a program administrator on a state level, and then how it's distributed across our counties and cities and our MnDOT districts. The qualifications of the personnel that do the bridge inspections in Minnesota and how we ensure that they're qualified, our inspection frequency and whether we're meeting it or not, the procedures that our inspectors use, and then the inventory of bridges that we submit to FHWA on an annual basis. They did some review of that database. And they found that we were in compliance with all the requirements of the NBIS. Additionally, and probably the most interesting part of this is PB Americas was also our consultant or lead consultant of a number of sub-consultants that did additional bridge inspections for us. And they inspected about 300 or so bridges on our system with their own personnel. And they were able to compare the results that these independent inspectors got with the results that the MnDOT or county or city inspectors had developed during the previous inspection cycle. And it was a really good sample and a really good comparison to see how an independent inspector would rate our bridges compared to the way that the Minnesota inspectors had rated our bridges in the past. And what they found was that they were very... very, very close in ratings, and they basically said they confirmed that our inspectors are doing what they're supposed to be doing as far as how they rate the bridges.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hill, if I remember that report right, they basically, every inspection that our bridge inspectors did almost mirrored the inspection that the consultant came back with.
That's correct. The goal of bridge inspection and rating is to be able to rate all the elements of the bridge within one rating code. So two inspectors could have a difference of one, and that would be acceptable, but greater than one is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And so they compared all of the bridges that they inspected in each of those rating codes and developed a table that said, well, we had a certain, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was a certain number of bridges that had a rating code difference of more than one, and it was very, very few, mm-hmm. on the range of a couple of percent. Mm-hmm. So that was the findings of their review. As far as recommendations, it was interesting. PB America's review was done after the legislative auditor, and after the joint committee report came out. So a lot of the recommendations are very similar. But one of the key things that they pointed out was that we need to do or develop a process and procedure for tracking our maintenance needs and our action items that get developed from bridge inspection findings. And within MnDOT, we have eight different districts that run their own bridge inspection programs, and they all do them their own way. And they identified the need to be consistent in how we track that information. They also pointed at a need for more inspection training for our district bridge engineers, which are the district program administrators. They've made a recommendation to hire more fracture-critical bridge inspectors, a recommendation to develop and document our inspection procedures for complex bridges. And complex bridges that they talked about were the bridges that have cables, like the Hennepin Avenue cable bridge would be one. And it would be a good example because there are Hennepin County does have an inspection manual that has procedures for inspecting that bridge. But there are a number of other cable bridges that have cables in Minnesota that don't have that similar inspection manual. And then another example they cited were our concrete box girder bridges, like the new I-35W bridge. Another one of their recommendations was to ensure that we get our inspection data entered into our database within 3 months of when the bridge is inspected. And that's something that we need to change how we do business to get that done. And we're working on that process right now. Another one was clarifying the responsibilities between the MnDOT fracture critical inspectors and the local agency inspectors. MnDOT serves as a consultant to the counties and cities on fracture critical bridge inspections. And partly because of familiarity, I think, we inspect their bridges, and a lot of times there's not very good coordination in what the MnDOT inspectors do and what the county inspectors do. And they cited problems in the inspection reports that kind of pointed to not very good communication between the two. So we've developed some procedures to address that. And the last thing was developing a standardized narrative bridge inspection report, and that specifically points to our fracture critical bridge inspections. And I think that's because each of our bridge inspectors kind of had their own way of writing a narrative report, and from one inspector to the next, there wasn't a lot of consistency in how they wrote those. So you couldn't find the same information in the same place from report to report. So what are we doing about these recommendations? One of the things is, one of the first recommendations I talked about was, what do we do about documenting post-inspection bridge maintenance activities? And PB, the legislative auditor, and the joint committee all recommended that we implement a standard process across our agency in doing this. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is that last summer we handed out an assessment form, which is a piece of paper, basically a checklist for the inspectors to bring in the field to identify maintenance needs as they were doing the inspections. And so that was implemented last summer, and the bridges that were inspected in this year's bridge inspection cycle used that process to collect information. Mm-hmm. And then early this month, we put out a standard spreadsheet for each district to compile those maintenance needs. And the key thing there is documenting what they are, prioritizing the needs, and then identifying what your decision about what's the time frame for addressing the need is, and then whether or not you followed up. And the idea behind the spreadsheet is that we can take each district, which there's 8 in MnDOT, all of them, compile those and be able to report on a mass scale for all of MnDOT what needs were accomplished and what needs weren't accomplished during the last year. And that'll help us identify whether we need more resources for bridge maintenance or mm-hmm. whether we have enough. Another one of the things that we learned and implemented was our fracture critical bridge inspection process is oftentimes a number of days of field work for our inspection crews, taking field notes, and then sometime later in the year, they will write a detailed report and send it to the bridge owner, which is either a county, a city, or the district. In the past, the district really didn't know about, or the owner, whether it was county, city, or district, didn't know about the results of that inspection unless there was something critical identified until that final report got published and sent to the district. And when I was working with this consultant to inspect the bridges, I needed to know, were they done with the bridge and what did they find? And we started a process requiring them to send us an email when they were done, telling us about the findings. And it worked really well, and we've implemented that with the MnDOT inspectors. So that's a quality assurance or quality control process improvement for our inspection program that we'd like to point out.
Senator Saltzman.
Dr. Mitchell, thank you very much. Just a question is that when some of us looked at some of the pictures that have been taken of the 35W bridge and of the corrosion, where we did not see notes, things seemed to look the same year to year. Mm-hmm. Is there a place in here to note how things are, like, you know, changing, progressing, that it may not need maintenance now, but over time, if you are unable to note from year one to year five, things have significantly changed? Is there a way to note that? And I'm not an expert in this area, but it did seem that there were some warning signs. That how were they noted, and, like, you know, measurements taken, for example, the supposed buckling of the gusset plate, where might that have been noted, like the buckle is getting worse, you know, those kind of things, please. Well,
those items that you're talking about are part of our fracture critical inspection, and what we want our inspectors to do is to identify the general condition of the steel elements and the condition of the paint, first of all. If it's starting to fail, they need to identify that there's corrosion beginning. And each of the inspection reports has a date on the inspection report. If the corrosion is advancing to a point where it's starting to compromise the structural integrity, our process is that we take measurements and we document the location of the measurements. And whether it's a critical area of the structural component or a non-critical area, so where is it in the member? Is it a high tension zone? Is it a high compression zone? Is it a shear area or a moment area? And document what that section loss is, and that will start the action or the chain of actions, whether it needs to be repaired or not, the decision process. And that should be documented in the inspection, the fracture critical inspection report, and it should also be documented in the routine inspection report.
And if I can add to that, Senator Saltzman, also, prior to going out on fracture critical inspections in particular, and I think most any bridge inspection, the inspectors do look at the past inspection reports and become familiar with, so they are very much looking for changes year to year. And comparing, and that information is available from the past inspection reports to compare to.
Okay, thank you very much.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, and I guess Mr. Dorgan or your other testifier here, you have an executive summary in each of these inspection reports, and in general you have the items broken down into long range, intermediate range, and then areas of concern. And this is, it feeds into what Senator Saltzman was talking about. And I'm hoping that it's going to become more clear here as you're telling us. But I guess what I'm interested in is, in the areas of concern, there are specific recommendations as to what needs to be done. And that was my concern after looking at a lot of the inspections of, for instance, the 35W bridge and also the Winona bridge, that some of these recommendations were being repeated for many, many years. And I know when we talked last June, there was going to be something in the procedure here where someone is the next stage after the inspector, and after the inspector writes the narrative, and then someone else has to actually confirm that this has been either decided to defer that maintenance or go ahead and do it. And that's what I'm concerned about is in areas of concern, we had a lot of issues here that had not been looked at for 10 or more years, sometimes 13 years. And I guess what I'd like to know is, in your new process, does someone sign their name to this not being done?
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, the previous slide that I showed, I get back to it, talked about documenting our post-inspection bridge maintenance. And our process for that documentation is a paper form that's filled out by the inspector in the field and reviewed by the district bridge engineer. And then a tracking, electronic tracking spreadsheet is the tool that we're trying to implement, where the bridge engineer makes the decision about the priority of need for that repair and the time frame that needs to be completed. And it also allows us to track whether or not it's been done in the time frame that we recommend. And that's the process that we've developed. The bridge engineer's responsibility is to sign the inspection report. We do not have a signature planned in that electronic document. The paper form I talked about, does have a review date and a signature on the form. That should go in the bridge file. So there should be a paper trail.
So, Mr. Chair, and what you're saying is that there is a paper trail here where someone is supposed to review it, but does that go back to the inspector then, that we have decided to defer this particular issue that you've brought up?
They'd have access to that information for their next inspection cycle, so yes, it would go back to them.
Mr. Chair, it's only a matter of access. It's not a direct feedback. And I guess some of the things that I'm thinking about here is that, again, areas of concern, these appeared like the inspectors thought they were important. And in fact, there's even some of them that, which is very unusual in a report such as this, where you'd use an exclamation point to try to get your point across to the person reviewing it. And if you use an exclamation point, it seems like the inspector is trying to draw attention to it. And it seems to me that it would be the right thing to do to feed that back to the inspector, that we have decided, someone has decided not to drill a hole in the end of a crack, for instance, or not to change a hinge joint, or something that they have put their name on and said that it needs to be done.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, you're correct. There should be feedback. It should be a verbal conversation between the reviewer and the inspector. But our process doesn't guarantee that that's going to happen. That's something that we would expect to happen, but our process isn't set up to guarantee that to happen. And it would be really difficult to document whether or not it did happen.
Mm-hmm. I think that
it's a very good comment. I think we can try to implement that.
Yeah, I'd agree, Duane, because I think what Senator Carlson, what you pointed out, and you know, it would be our expectation that if an inspector brings something to me as the inspection engineer and I've determined that, you know, your first four items, we need to address those. We're going to get three of them done this year, one next year because we can. But item five really is not that critical and is an item that really can continue to be monitored. Then we need to let the inspector know that for their own learnings as to why that decision was made. So I think that's something we'll take back with us.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. One other thing that we've undertaken in our fracture critical inspection process that we would be under the quality control, quality assurance area, is to have an in-depth review by a structural engineer of the inspection report prior to finalizing it. And the idea of that is to ensure that we've got an engineer that's looked at the report, that's able to identify where the critical findings properly resolved and promptly resolved. Are the conclusions that the inspector and the report writer stated correct and logical? Is the structure functioning as designed from their point of view? And are there repair recommendations that need to be added to the list from that report? And then lastly, we want one additional set of eyes looking at that report, looking at the condition of the bridge to ensure that if the load rating is proper, fine, but if it needs to be reviewed, let's get a recommendation to have that reviewed. The other step, part of that process, is once the report's finalized, in the past we mailed that to the bridge owner, whether it be a county engineer or a city engineer or a MnDOT district, and they took the report, but there wasn't a paper trail or an acknowledgement of receipt. So we developed a process where we asked the bridge owner to acknowledge receipt of the report and acknowledge the fact that they read it and understand the recommendations, and if they have concerns or questions about the recommendations, that's the time to have that discussion about those recommendations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that slide that you just had up there, you had a bullet point that dealt with the load rating being reevaluated. I was, I suppose that would deal with the overlay load rating or the traffic load rating or additional lanes being added to the bridge and assessing the, you know, the design of the bridge and whether it can deal with the load. Are you doing anything dealing with the loading of the bridge during the construction or process that would deal with the loading of the bridge during that time frame?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, yes, and let me get your second question first, but this on this note, should the load rating be evaluated, you know, that could be triggered by finding corrosion where the inspector had looked at a steel element and decided that 10% of the section was lost or 15 or usually about 15% is where we get concerned that you could be negatively impacting that load rating. So those are the different triggers for conducting a load rating or a crack in concrete, perhaps. Your second question dealt with construction loads. We have, and this is another outcome from the NTSB results. Last in August of 2007, shortly after the collapse, Federal Highways put out an advisory on construction loads. And we subsequently then developed a specification putting in restrictions on construction loads, giving the contractor certain limitations that they could place loads on the bridge, which generally reflect normal traffic loads that a bridge would carry. Anything above that, they need to submit a request and along with an analysis by a registered engineer. So construction, so that is part of our construction contracts. That was implemented as with our contract starting in 08 as a new requirement in those contracts. So does that, Senator, address your questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And is that load during construction process change that you just talked about different from what you had in the past, or how much?
Well, in, let's see, Senator, members of the committee, in the past we had a specification in place that limited the mainly the weight of vehicles and that the contractor could bring onto the bridge during construction, and those were limited to normal legal loads. It was not specific, though, about construction materials, stockpiling material. So that was the modification we made. We extended that current. That the spec that had been placed probably for over 40 years or so not only now applies to vehicles but also to material.
Thank you.
Okay, Duane had just discussed the quality assurance practice for fracture critical bridges. I'm going to now talk about also for routine inspections. So these are, since fracture criticals are a smaller subset, routine inspections cover all our bridges. And this has been a process that's been in place. It's been a longstanding quality assurance practice. But I know it was one of the items, I think, cited by the report to the Joint Committee that the legislature should be fully informed about our quality assurance and quality control practices. We're actually currently condensing all those into a single document. That's still a work in progress because we have quality control and quality assurance practices for fracture critical. We have it for routine, for other types of inspections. So we are not only going to continue to carry those in their specific areas, but condense that into one area and place that in our inspection manual. But our longstanding process on quality assurance is that inspection reports, when they're completed, are reviewed and they are signed off on by the program administrator, and that is a registered engineer. So within our MnDOT districts, there would be a registered engineer reviewing and signing those. The same occurs on the county system. The county engineer typically signs off, reviews and signs off on their own inspection reports. So that is one of the steps in that quality assurance process. And, of course, the expectation is by signing off, if you have questions and want to talk to the inspector further, something is unclear or you think you need to pursue it, then we expect that engineer will follow up on those issues prior to signing that. There are annual audits also conducted by both MnDOT and Federal Highways, and this is done according to the National Bridge Inspection Standards. We look at approximately every year 20 to 25 counties, cities, and districts all told. And we review those, and we have a questionnaire that goes out to 20 to 25 agencies. Those are reviewed, and of those, then we select 8 to 12 for actual audits. And our staff has actually been out in the last month up in the northwest end of the states reviewing counties in our district up there along with cities. So they receive an actual field review then where the staff goes through their inspection procedures, the qualifications of their staff to make sure they are certified and meeting requirements. They go through their inspection files. They also go out and do a field inspection of a bridge and compare it to whatever that inspection agency had for an inspection on that particular bridge. So this is a process that's longstanding in place, and we probably haven't articulated it well enough because I know there was a lot of questions over the last year as to what type of QA QC was being done. This is a map of the state just showing from 2006 through 2010 the areas that we've either we do this geographically, and you can see this year, it's a little hard to read, but the dark green color up in the upper left is where we are in 2008 up in the northwest end of the state, going through those agencies. I think the counties that are listed here were the counties and cities along with districts that were audited in 2007. So again, this is conducted every year as part of that quality assurance effort. We've also implemented, and this really stems from, I think, the legislative auditor from their report. MnDOT districts, typically they complete their routine inspections. They enter the information into the statewide database, which is known as PONTUS. It's the Latin word for bridge. But it's a database that's maintained by the bridge office. And what we found, I know it was cited in the legislative audit report that the inspections, first of all, they were getting done, but they were not always getting done exactly on, in the case of the 24-month cycle, exactly on the 24-month cycle. I think the statistics they had cited, I had written them down here, were 86% were being completed in 24 months, 97% were completed in 24 months plus the 90-day sort of grace period that we have to get those entered in the database, and the other 3% were completed but would have been at somewhat of a longer schedule. So we've been working on that in the past year. We've set up a tracking system, We're notifying districts quarterly of inspections that our records show are either 1 month, 3 months overdue, or the results have not been entered. And at times these inspections have been done, but the inspector has done a number of them, set the pile on their desk, and they're going to enter them in when they're a day in the office. But we need to get to a rigid cycle, so we're working towards that, mm-hmm. and that process is in place.
Right. Mr. Dorgan, these were routine inspections. These had nothing to do with fracture critical bridges? Or?
Correct. This generally applies to the routine, but we're also tracking our fracture criticals also, because those we need to have done on 24-month cycle. So we'll apply the same type of scrutiny to that cycle.
Now, sure I just wanted to make sure that the record reflected that the 3% that were routine inspections, they weren't fracture critical bridges or other structures that may have an issue.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for that clarification. Yes, that was the auditor's report, was the overall mm-hmm. routines. In addition, another step as part of our quality assurance and quality control involves inspector training. We have, again, been conducting these for a number of years. I mentioned earlier we have refresher training, sort of continuing education to maintain your certification. So those training courses are held typically in February when it's not inspection season. So we have a refresher training being held multiple locations around the state. Our staff goes out to conduct that training, and the reason we go out state is to try to make it convenient for counties, cities, and our own districts so they don't all have to travel into a central location. So those are conducted around the state at various locations. And your handout in the appendix on the very last, I believe this is the very last page, shows the different topics that are covered as part of that training. It was page 30, showed the topics that were covered in 2008 training and also those that are tentatively being covered here in 2009. So we are updating inspection staff, not only counties, cities, but also consultants that are certified in what might be the latest changes from the National Bridge Inspection System, also on topics of the moment, and certainly this year, fracture critical, gusset plate inspections, results of the I-35 will be topics as part of that training. I think we have a question here.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And to Mr. Dorgan, and I'll kind of explain my question a little bit before I ask the direct question. As you well know, we're going through a pretty good-sized deficit. We probably got another 250 some million we got to do relatively quick. And then has anybody approached you or your bridge program about any cuts in? I take it that somewhere along the line the governor is going to transportation and saying, would you put together 10% or whatever. And I'm just, has anybody in your department asked you to take any cuts?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, certainly the answer is no. Inspection is something that's required by law. In Minnesota, it's required nationally. So on the inspection effort, we're actually, as we mentioned earlier, actually adding staff in the inspection area. Part of that was thanks to the additional funding that was supplied earlier this year from the transportation bill. So, our intent is to add staff. We're going to fully meet our inspection requirements. That would be the last area we'd reduce any efforts in.
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Day,
I think all of us appreciate that nobody's asking you that, and I think if mm-hmm. that does happen, hopefully you'll get to Senator Murphy and the chairman here really pretty fast, because I don't think Minnesotans want us to cut in this area. So.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Senator Day. We're not going to skimp on safety. That's for sure. Just so the members know, and Mr. Dorgan's right, I don't believe that we're going to see any you know, federal bridge rescission of monies. You know, we're not going to see the bridge office being asked to participate in any of these cuts. Besides, you know, the money coming into the Department of Transportation is almost all constitutionally dedicated, and we can't cut any of that money and give it back to the general fund because it's in the Constitution, which is good. But the one thing that is going to happen, because we know that people are driving less, gas tax revenues are off, the projection for MVEST and is someplace between 9% and 11% off for the next biennium. So there are going to be cuts to the organization, but they're going to be cuts just knowing that there's that less and less revenue, and it's going to be on the construction side. We're not going to put our bridge office in jeopardy. We're not going to cut back on a lot of the maintenance activities that are currently going on, you know, to bring a lot of our roadways up to snuff. But people need to brace themselves. I think you're going to see fewer large construction projects in the next couple of years. And that's, unfortunately, just the way it's got to be. Senator Langstaff.
Mr. Chair, some of the costs are going down through the roof. What prices will be down on asphalt? So you've got assessment. I think steel is now moving down. It's somewhat offsetting at least.
And the Chinese quit buying all the steel, so we have some available to us. Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chair, with your what you were just talking about, are we, this probably doesn't have much to do with bridges, but it actually might have a lot to do with bridge construction, and that's gearing up for if the new administration in Washington does a relief package that's job stimulus and has infrastructure projects. I wonder if we have some off the, you know, plans on the shelf to take advantage of those dollars. We were talking about that design build, and they want to move quick, and
right.
Are we in a position to make full use of that?
Well, Senator Olstein, I don't know how much Mr. Dorgan can unfold here, and probably not much in that regard. It's my understanding that those projects that are currently in the STIP program are going to qualify for this money. I mean, they're on the board. For the most part, you know, you can pick the top five of any district, and they're pretty much ready to go. And those are the ones that are going to be eligible for any money that we might get from the federal government under the stimulus package. I think that, and that's going to be good. I think that, you know, we don't need to ask the federal government not to send us any money. It'd be nice to have it so that we can do things, and if there's not a lot of strings attached, we can make sure that Mr. Dorgan and his group get a nice chunk of that money to help us with our bridge program, because every dollar is needed. We all know that. But I think long term we need to look at the reauthorization of the federal of the federal bill, and work with Congressman Obistar and Walls and the rest of the members on that committee to make sure that Minnesota's priorities are well understood. This first get off of money, it's my understanding that they're not going to earmark any of that money. It's going to be money that's challenging states to improve their economic climate. And not only with the construction of bridges and roads and dams and new buildings, but strategically using those investments to spur further development in those areas. And I'm, you know, I just know from talking with a lot of city engineers and county engineers that we've got projects that they're going to qualify for this money at all levels of government, up and down the scale. So I think Minnesota is positioned fairly well. You know, our department working with the local jurisdictions through STIP processes, things like that, have already established a healthy catalog of work that could go out the door right away. So, Mr. Dorgan, I saved you from that one.
You certainly did, Senator. Thank you. and I learned something too. Getting back to the training, then the refresher courses are one aspect of the training. We also annually have bridge safety training, a two-course sequence, because we have a number of inspectors. Not only MnDOT, but also our county cities have a need for inspection training. So those first two classes listed are conducted every year. This year we'll also have the fracture critical inspection class scheduled. And these are conducted typically in February and March. And with the fracture critical, with new staff coming on board, we scheduled that again this year. So these are courses that meet all the national requirements for certification. Let's see, technical, and I'm getting near the end here, technical memorandums. In February of this year, we updated several of our technical memos that provide direction to inspection staff. One was on critical deficiencies that are found in bridge inspections, and earlier Duane identified those, and as these are items that would be found during an inspection that the inspector believes may threaten the safety of the bridge. And as he mentioned, our inspectors are empowered, and I know Duane said part of that process is to notify the bridge office, but I also want to assure you that our inspectors clearly understand if they need to take immediate action to take it, and then notify us after. So they exercise that, feel that's clearly understood by our inspection staff. So there isn't a bureaucratic process to try to address the issue, but we do, obviously, once something like that's found, we do want a clear process to make sure it's resolved. We updated also our fracture critical inspection information based on the latest NBIS, and that also covers underwater inspections, so lays out the procedures, the frequency, the qualifications there. Just a couple last slides, too, and these really relate to new technology that we're looking at. This is inspection equipment and technology. We always, of course, seek to have our inspectors equipped with the latest equipment, but that's an ongoing effort, and technologies do change. So in the last year, we've ordered additional both ultrasonic and magnetic particle testing equipment. Part of that's because of our expansion and inspection staff. We need more equipment. We've also updated. There are some newer forms of ultrasonic testing equipment for flaw detection that was available, and we've purchased those. And along those lines, that was one of the items also cited by NTSB, that all states should be using this type of equipment to inspect in areas where they cannot visually see. So particularly in areas where there is steel coming together and you can't get behind there to see it, ultrasonic is used to measure that thickness. It's similar to technology used in the medical professions. We're also contracting for ground-penetrating radar. This is to look at decks for delamination, and that'll be a subject I'm going to cover probably on the next slide, I believe. The photo that's shown on the right are some of our efforts to review automation software and devices that are available for electronic data collection to aid our inspection staff. And the goal here is sort of twofold. One is automation to make a life easier for them, and so they can perform their tasks more efficiently. But also with this software, and I know Duane was one that was helped review that, past inspection data, not only photos but reports, would be immediately available. So we're looking at the different technologies available there, and I think it goes back to maybe one of Senator Saltzman's earlier questions, that that's particularly a benefit if you're looking at something in the field and want to see how does that compare to how it looked last year. So you, with some of the new technology, they may be able to just pull the photo right up there and compare. Okay. We are ordering one additional snooper. Those are actually manufactured in Duluth by a company in Duluth, and then we've added also we've ordered a trailer-mounted inspection platform, a lighter weight inspection access equipment that we can use on posted bridges that can't carry the weight of our snooper.
Mr. Dorgan, how much one of those snooper trucks cost?
I think they're on the order of about $700,000, $750,000. about $750,000.
All right. When the department, maybe this is for Mr. Peterson, when the department brings forward your recommendations on the budget, if we could see where we're at as far as a technology account for the bridge department and what kind of resources you're going to apply to that, and also the training account in their department, I'd be appreciative. Mr. Dorick.
Okay.
We just want to make sure you got enough money to train your bridge inspectors, train your trainers, and you know, have the proper technology to do your jobs.
And Senator and members of the committee, the I was just thinking the task that just been assigned to Mr. Peterson might be a little difficult, because there isn't so much a specific. There is a department budget for equipment, and we make requests to that, but our requests are all being acted upon. So I guess, okay, we can show it in that terms, equipment requests.
Well, maybe we can just get a historical perspective then on, sure, on what kind of money you've spent on the technology.
Okay. Very good. I mentioned, I think, on the earlier slide about ground penetrating equipment and deck delaminations. And I wanted to cover one of the topics we thought we should cover is the Maryland Avenue incident that occurred in July of 2008. Our bridge crews, when they have done inspections, our bridge inspectors, have routinely identified, and then our crews have removed loose concrete from older structures when they have found that. Unfortunately, with the Maryland Avenue Bridge, we did have that incident where concrete did fall off the underside of a bridge and did strike a vehicle in July. The previous inspections certainly had been done, but had not detected that a spall was imminent. And the inspection staff was looking at that issue, but it was not identified at that location. So we have sent out further guidance to our districts, and that was done both in July, August, again in September, along with information on what might be the highest priorities for them to look at. And our districts are actively looking at their bridges for any type of spalling. And again, they have always done this, but I think the efforts were probably increased attention has been paid to that in light of what happened with Maryland. So those efforts are going to continue. In effect, they'll probably be seeing some removals this winter. I know Metro is continuing to work on that through 2009. We're using man lifts to get closer probably than we have before, and sounding with hammers when needed. In our districts, prior to the Maryland incident, had actually removed concrete from about 30 bridges that year, and since then, additional 40 were removed in 2008.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
Is that structural? I mean, when you see a big chunk of concrete falling out of that bridge, it seems like, you know, aren't you losing a lot of your strength?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, on the particular case of the Maryland Bridge, the main supporting elements there are the beams. This is a freeway bridge. As you drive under, you'll see a series of beams above with a concrete deck on top. So what was lost there, the underside of the concrete deck, was what we call the cover over the reinforcing. It is not a main structural element. The beams are the more critical piece on that bridge. But on other types of bridges, if you lose concrete, it could be a structural element on a concrete bridge, certainly. That happens to be steel beams supporting the Maryland bridge there. So the main purpose of the cover is to protect the steel from corrosion in that area. That bridge was scheduled for replacement, so our choice there was to remove anything loose. It's going to be replaced in a few years, so no repair was needed on that particular one. Other bridges, we do have to at times make those repairs.
And Mr. Dorgan, the issue of spalling is, the way it's been explained to me, is sometimes a little more difficult to identify than some of these other issues that we've been talking about. Can you maybe expand on that just a little bit? We're kind of running short, so I want to
Certainly.
Go on.
Let's see. Senator, members of the committee, the as you inspect the underside of the bridge, concrete cracks. That's normal. You'll see it in your sidewalks. You see it in bridge decks. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is look at it fairly close to see certain patterns, and at times you'll see what looks like how to describe it, sort of an alligator type skin. Evidence of wetness in the underside of the deck is often a sign that the deck is deteriorating. The best thing is to get as close as possible. At times, the spall, it really isn't identified until you hammer away at it. Dwayne, if you've got anything.
That's exactly the way I would describe it. Is some of these, you can't see them with the naked eye from a distance, and if you don't hit it with a hammer, you won't know that it's going to come down until it does.
Yeah. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dargan, now from what I understand, that you did find those particular problems with a tap test, and is the tap test being not used as much? And that involved the inspector actually hitting it with a hammer, and you could tell from the sound that there was instability or some separation. And from what I'm understanding, from rumor, legend, and people telling me about it, is that we're not doing as much of the tap testing as we used to do.
Let's see, Senator Carlson, members of the committee, I've never heard it called a tap test. I just sounding, but our inspectors, are doing that when they're suspicious. I think the first thing, of course, is thinking that's the underside of a bridge deck above us, the first thing you do is a visual exam. And then if you see areas you're suspicious, you would try to get access and perform just what you said. If you were uncertain, strike it with a hammer. But certainly newer decks, you can look and see no deficiencies. There isn't a reason to get closer. It's mainly when you see areas that you become suspicious of that you would get the access and get up there and look at them. So, our inspectors always they carry the hammer with them. That's a, I don't mean to scare you, but that's a frequent inspection tool on concrete, is to hit it with a hammer to see how solid it is, and that's a good technique. So that they always have that with them. I'm not sure, we wouldn't have any records to show how frequently it was being used before or after, but certainly a lot of attention is being placed on that now.
And from what I'm, after this incident with the Maryland Bridge, there was an opportunity for me to tell a story about one of my constituents who was driving along the crosstown, and her car was hit by a piece of concrete. And what we didn't know for sure was where that piece of concrete came from, because when it hit her, it hit right on the cowling, broke her windshield, and it shattered. And she couldn't stop because it was rush hour. She did talk to the department, and I believe they sent someone out there, but they said they couldn't confirm that there was a problem with the France Avenue Bridge. I went out there afterward, some time afterward, and to look at it myself just to find out, because I was getting a lot of calls from people talking about bridge condition, all that sort of thing. But I did see that the Xerxes Bridge did have a lot of material falling off, and you could see the reinforcing rods. And then I've also talked to other people that talked about the Cayuga, and that evidently you are doing some mesh encasement to prevent any of the larger pieces from actually falling down and maybe hitting a car or a person. Are you using that as a method to defer the maintenance, putting a mesh on any of those?
Doing a mesh, I'm not so much familiar with, but we do at times do what we call underpinning. And when a deck is, and that's usually put in with timber between the beams and shoring up for a bridge that typically we, it's not so much to defer maintenance, but for something that maybe is scheduled for replacement within a short time frame, a couple years from now, we might underpin an area that is weaker. The mesh, and I'm not, there could be a maintenance crew using some mesh for some reason, Senator. I guess I'm just not familiar with that or haven't seen that myself. I'm more familiar with wood underpinning that we've put up. But again, it's not so much to defer maintenance as perhaps the bridge is scheduled for replacement next year. So we would do that as a short term as opposed to replace the whole deck and make that investment. The underpinning is meant to shore it up and keep anything loose from dropping. Mm-hmm. And that would be a considerably older structure, a deck that's maybe 50 years old or so.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'd like to also say that I was on 35E that day and was caught in the traffic backup because of that. And so it was very personal to me. I didn't see the actual incident or see the vehicles that had been struck because I had to detour around it. But it does make you very concerned, and I think we really dodged a bullet there that it wasn't just a little bit later and went through the windshield on anybody's. I think there was a van that it hit. It is very concerning.
And, Senator, we'd certainly agree. We're very concerned with it, too. So our districts are putting in, along with their normal efforts, they're putting in, I'd say, an extraordinary effort this year on that issue because we certainly – that's not acceptable to us either, and we don't want those kind of things occurring.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Dorgan, if we could pick up the pace here.
Okay.
We have Ms. McCormick has been waiting here, and we want to
okay, then
move along.
Finish these up quickly. I just wanted to let you know national involvement. We have always been involved nationally, but I think this year we feel an obligation to share our experiences, so I want to assure you that we're doing that with other states in whatever forums that are available. We're sharing our experiences from 35W. The process we've used to review gusset plates has been shared with other states to assist them. And so we're trying to make certain that everyone can learn from our tragedy. And lastly, I guess in the interest of time, won't dwell too long on this, but bridge monitoring, as you're probably well aware, it's been publicized, there's a state-of-the-art monitoring system in I-35. We also have an installation going in on the Wakota Bridge that's currently under construction, the eastbound. But we have been using different monitoring systems since the 1990s and have done this usually as a research effort with the University of Minnesota, mainly to look at specific problems or at times to monitor repairs. So we're continuing to look at monitoring systems and working with the U of M on bridge monitoring systems. And long term, they'll be working with us on I-35 on that data. So with that, Senator and members of the committee, that concludes our comments. So I hope we've achieved our goal of sharing information with you on inspections and bringing you up to date, and we'd welcome calls at any time and any questions if you have any time. Or
right, and Mr. Dorgan, our door is always open as well, and we've had conversations about this coming legislative session and any changes that the department sees that would help improve the program legislatively, all you need to do is bring those ideas forward, and we'll work with you to get it done. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, maybe we could, if you already illuminated us before I came in, or if I missed it, I apologize. But I just wanted to pick up just very quickly on a point that Senator Skoy had raised. And it has to do with loading, and specifically, there's some attention been paid to, the maintenance work being done on the 35W bridge and staging the material before it was being used in the trucks and the traffic, as well as, where we're pouring wet cement and where we want it to dry first before we pour other wet cement. What's being done to work with those those folks who aren't necessarily bridge contractors per se, but are more, you know, road contractors, to make sure that all of that's being handled in a fashion that is a little more safe.
Okay. Senator Dibble and members of the committee, as far as working close to previously poured concrete, there are restrictions in our specification already, longstanding on that, because we're always concerned with the vibration or disturbing concrete that's trying to set up. So we have restrictions in place. And perhaps what you may have missed and that I covered earlier was following the collapse in August of 2007, Federal Highways put out an advisory to states on construction loads. So since that time, we have changed our contract specifications on construction loads to specifically put restrictions on materials contractors can stockpile on a bridge while it's under construction. So that's in addition to the previous specification that was in there restricting vehicle weights and contractors' vehicles. So, and I can't recall if you were here at, that's yeah. probably news to you, but and, we have had that in place for contracts since earlier this year.
I suspected that was dealt with. I just needed to hear it out loud. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Dorgan, Mr. Hill. Thanks for coming over and enlightening us.
You're welcome. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. And next, Ms. McCormick is going to come up, and we're going to talk just a little bit about some things that are going on inside of vehicle services. First, for the benefit of the MnDOT employees here, Senator Dibble and myself and a few others were at a conference this past week in Atlanta where we talked a lot about bridges and road maintenance. And the reason why I was adamant at the beginning of the meeting in regards to our bridge department, and I feel very comfortable that our bridge department is making the changes necessary to continue that gold standard in the bridge area. And that's an opinion that, as I said earlier, that's not only shared by me, but by legislators across the United States. And when we were down there in Atlanta, they had just relieved two people of their jobs because they were forging documents on bridge inspection. And folks, our people do the work that's required. And they don't put their initials on anything unless they actually do it. And, you know, it was disturbing to hear what kind of practices are occurring in some other states, but it's also reassuring to know that we do still have the gold standard. And with that, I found out two other things. One, that Scott Dibble, the vice chair of the Transportation Committee for NCSL, is highly thought of across the United States as being a leader on transportation and transit issues. And I just wanted to say that publicly, that I had a lot of people talk about Senator Dibble and his involvement with
NCSL.
I'll slip
your 20 to you later.
Okay. Well, it's going to be more than that.
I'm
from Illinois.
Don't get greedy.
Oh, come on, that was funnier than that smattering of laughter. But the other thing that I found out is that Ms. McCormick is also pretty highly thought of throughout the United States in the area of her field, and had several people come up to me. We had some issues with suspensions on driver's license, and your name came up, and there were several other administrators there from other states, and they had a lot of high praise for you and your department. So,
well, thank you, Senator.
It was good to hear that.
Thank
so,
you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I just want to say, if folks have any morbid curiosity, this report that was given on the Georgia program was really interesting. There was a guy who came and presented from the equivalent of their legislative auditor, and he said, he just stopped for a minute and he just gave an editorial aside, and he said, this is far and away the worst program evaluation. He said it was unbelievable kind of how lax and unprofessional all of the work that was being done in their bridge inspection program was. And then he, of course, gave the example of the inspectors signing off on inspections reports, never having set site on those bridges. So it did make us feel good in Minnesota that we have a crew of professionals that really do a good job here. Thanks.
Senator Jungbauer.
I was just going to say speak to the Georgia issue. You know, I've always thought of myself as a conservative in Minnesota until I met Georgians and what they thought about protecting their environment. Then I felt like a liberal instantly. So I think it speaks to the way the state operates in general.
Yeah,
down
could
there.
Be. With that, Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And we really appreciate this opportunity to update you on what is now called our Minnesota Licensing and Registration System Project. MNLARS is the acronym, and we had a contest with our staff in DVS, and this was the chosen name for the project. And we think it sounds better than the whole name talking about it. It's much easier for us within the division to talk about it using the acronym. So we'll be using that from now on and to talk about the project. And as you know, you had provided us money for a pre-design project, and we have been working diligently on that. We're finishing that project up, and we will have a report to describe our activities during that part of the project. We now are beginning to work on MNLARS. We had requested funding for it, and the technology surcharge of $1.75 was enacted into law and became effective July 1st. We are right on target in terms of what we need to be collecting. It's about $1 million a month. We're estimating that this project will cost over 4 years about $48 million. As of yesterday, we had collected $5.8 million for this project, and obviously we've needed to build cash to be able to begin the actual work on the project. So we're hoping to kick it off right after the first of this year. We had spent quite a bit of time talking to other states in terms of the size of their system, the population of drivers, and the number of vehicles that are registered within other states, and we feel that the $48 million is a very accurate amount. Most of the systems that of states that we've talked about were between $35 and $50 million. Some were a little bit more, but in terms of states that were comparable to Minnesota, we thought $48 million seems to be on target. And so our project timeline is that we, as I said, we're starting it in fiscal year 2009, and the costs include the planning, the development, and the implementation. Obviously, when we reach the final year in 2012, we'll have to assess if we need additional funding for maintenance. By then, we'll have a good idea in terms of what our current maintenance costs are for our current system as well as the new system. But we believe that we can really move forward. What I gave you in terms of a handout talks a little bit about our project approach, and that would be to begin working on our business process engineering, re-engineering. We've done some of that in our initial stages of the pre-design. We're continuing to work on that. We should have a project plan available for you fairly close to the beginning of the next session, so we'll have something to share with you at that time. Then obviously we have to determine, and as part of that project plan, how we're going to go about it. What we've talked initially to you about, and it's still our plan, is to chunk the system down and work on different parts of it as we need to. Obviously we have some things that need to get done earlier than other things. We have two very important federal requirements we need to address. One is the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act. We did pass structured testing. We were able to keep the highway funding that we had to pass it by October 1st, and we passed it by the middle of September, so we made it under the wire. But now we have to implement it by October of 2010. And so we have laid out a project to implement motor carrier safety improvement by April of 2010, so that because there would be another penalty if we didn't implement it within that timeline. So we think we'll be fine. We're incorporating that as part of this project. Also, the Department of Justice has had a court order that all states must implement the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System as soon as possible, and they have some federal regulations that have been under review, and they will be published shortly. So our staff is working on getting that plan together, because we will need to comply and at least provide batch data initially, so that all states are providing data in order to assist consumers and law enforcement, so that they know where that vehicle was titled previously, and is it a title that is valid, and is it an authentic title, and those kinds of things. So we're busy working on those. In addition to working on this project. I think just in laying out our project goals again, we are hoping that this system would communicate with other technology systems, as you all know that we need to be able to do. We have many stakeholders within the state as well as within the United States, and we need to be able to communicate with our deputies and our DL agents, but also in our dealers, but also the courts, law enforcement, and many other state agencies that we share data with. We also need to improve the accuracy of our data, and especially ensure that we're getting accurate data to law enforcement as soon as possible. It's important for us that we can provide and become less of an information storage system and more of an information management system, so that our staff have good access to information and they can help our customers at the first point of contact rather than calling back or trying to get through or whatever. And having accurate data really helps with that as well, so that we're not having to check on more things and get back to customers. And flexibility is the name of the game, because right now we aren't a flexible system, and so any new projects that come up, it's very difficult for us to be able to respond in any kind of a timely manner in terms of getting what our constituents or stakeholders need in terms of working with our system. We also need to improve our coordination regarding commercial drivers, and that's where the Motor Carrier Safety Administration Act implementation comes in, and also to increase our online services, because obviously that's very important in this day and age that our customers have other ways to access us. So those are kind of the goals that we have for the project, and I'm glad to take any questions or issues that you'd like to discuss.
before I go to Senator Dibble, I know that if Senator Rest was here, she would ask about using the credit cards to pay for your tabs or whatever transaction we're making here, and if you've made any headway in that area.
We have a working group that has been meeting. It's included our deputy registrars and representatives from the counties association, as well as people from the Department of Finance and our own staff to talk about it. We will have a report for you by the beginning of February, as was required in last session's law, and we hope to lay out some options. I can tell you that the biggest impediment we have right now is that without allowing our customers to pay the convenience fees, we'd have to raise our fees substantially in order to pay for them, for our customers to have access, you know, to be able to use credit cards. And obviously with this session, we wouldn't see that. We will certainly bring those forward as what we've gathered in terms of information. MasterCard and Discover have programs with motor vehicle agencies to allow customers to pay that credit card convenience fee. Visa, which is the card of choice in Minnesota for about 60% of our residents, so far won't let us or will not allow any motor vehicle agency to use that process. They will only use it for property taxes. And so we have sent a letter to Visa and requested them to respond to us by mid-January, requesting that we be able to pilot a project to see if it would, you know, what if they could try us out at least and see if we would be allowed to do that, so that customers could use the credit card, but they would be paying the convenience fee and not the state, if that was their choice in terms of payment. So we're hoping to have that response by the time we present our report to you. And so we'll present all the options, that's one thing that we're hoping we'll hear from, so that we can really give you a full understanding of the issues.
Yeah, well, I wanted to make sure that people knew that it was the credit card company, Visa, primarily, that is kind of holding the show up here. So, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just responding to that quickly, it would be my desire and advice that we just proceed and let folks know that if they want to use their Visa, they should, and they can't, they should call Visa. And I think pretty soon Visa will come around, because they'll figure out that they're losing some business. If MasterCard and the others are willing to go ahead, fine, let's just go with them. Cool. And then Visa will come along afterwards if they feel like they want that book of business. I did have another question.
Just think about that, though. 60% of people use Visa as their card of choice. And how many motorists, or how many registered vehicles do we have out there, Ms. McCormick?
Well, we have about 6 million vehicles.
And just think of the number of transactions that, even if 20% of the Visa cardholders used their card to purchase tabs or whatever from the department, just think of the revenue that they would make. So I'm with you. I don't understand what their problem is.
Well, we did in our letter, we did enumerate the numbers of transactions that we do on a yearly basis in hopes that they might reconsider what kind of, you know, number we're talking, what kind of volume we're talking about, and so we'll have to see if we're successful or not, but we're hoping we will be.
Senator Dibble, you had another question?
Yeah, my ears pricked up a little bit on this Department of Justice court order on the titling issue. So who's the subject of this court order, and why is it our problem, and are they giving us any money to help comply with their court order?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, it really has to do with some consumer organizations that this act went into place a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago or longer, I think. And there was never any funding for this project. And so what happened is the Department of Justice worked with the American Motor Vehicle Administrators Association, and states assisted, and they gave some startup money. There was a small grant to get the project started, but states had to provide the data at their own expense. And in addition to that, it has been putting the AMVA, that organization, into deficit in terms of trying to run the program. And so it has been hard for them to, for the Department of Justice working with AMVA to expand the program. And states have, for instance, Minnesota and other states that have legacy systems that aren't flexible enough to easily provide this data, and plus it's another expense for the states, haven't been able to do it. And so I, these consumer groups just decided that they needed to sue the Department of Justice because they feel it's very important for them to have this information. So that's where, why there's a court order. So we have, we submitted comments to the regulations, and in those comments we stressed the fact that we believed that it was an unfunded mandate and that we hoped that the federal government, if they were going to start making these requirements, that they would also provide some assistance. And there is a grant that will assist us to get started that we are applying for, but it's not enough money to keep the whole program going nationally either. So they're looking for large organizations that may need this data to be able to provide enough funding that'll keep the system going. So it's kind of a a project being worked on at this time.
Well, Mr. Chair, sounds like an unfunded mandate to me. Sounds like we need to maybe engage our congressional delegation on this. So, Ms. McCormick, if perhaps we could visit about this and maybe figure out a way to fashion, some communication with our federal representatives on that.
Well, I if you want to take the lead on that, Senator Dibble, please do. But this is a very important component nationally,
mm-hmm.
and it is a consumer issue,
mm-hmm.
because when we buy automobiles or pickup trucks or whatever, we want to make sure that that is the vehicle,
mm-hmm.
that we're buying, and that it's not a vehicle that might have been in New Orleans,
right?
Like 2 years ago.
Yeah. I agree. It's a good thing, Mr. Chair, to do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's lots of good things to do that we get told mm-hmm. we must do from on high.
Right, and it's a lot easier to do those must-dos mm-hmm. if they send a wheelbarrow full of money along mm-hmm. as well. We all know that, mm-hmm. but how often does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
So. Does anybody have anything else? Ms. McCormick?
No, I think that's all that we have, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, other than we just want you to know that we'll be putting some of our best business staff, we'll be moving them to the project and filling behind with other staff within the division so that we're sure we've got really good leadership on the business side of this project so that we can meet the timelines that you've given us and work with the funding that we've been given to come up with a really effective system that'll be good for Minnesota.
So. Yeah, and thanks again, Ms. McCormick, and thank your troops again. They do a remarkable job with little. And in that regard, right now there is a fund balance in that technology account that Ms. McCormick's agency has. And it's going to be incumbent upon us not to try to raid that because the items that they're buying are millions of dollars strong, and they need to have that fund balance there at periodic times to pay for this equipment that we all know that the state needs. So, Senator Carlson, Senator Jungbauer.
Senator Murphy and Ms. McCormick, and we're trying to figure out if we actually passed it now, but there was that issue with bad checks and being able to suspend a driver's license that we had in the policy bill. I think that survived, and I'm wondering if that mm-hmm. has been implemented and if that's being successful.
Well, I need Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, we already had a NSF check policy in place, and so We have it on one side of the business. Is this the one on the vehicle side of the business that
right.
we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Let me get back to you to make sure that that was that we have done that. I thought we did pass that as part of this. It was just extending what we already do with our deputy registrars, if I'm not mistaken. So I think mm-hmm. that's why we haven't really had much of a change other than in terms of they can do it on both sides of our business, where before they just did it on the driver's license side. So let me verify, mm-hmm. and I'll get back to you for sure, but it seems to me we did.
Senator John Bauer.
Well, I was just thinking out loud for the committee that there's certainly nobody in our administration here that would, say, want to rob a fund balance in order to balance a budget, is there?
Well, I think kind of towards the end of the session, you're going to see 67 people kind of getting in that line to raid those fund balances, because this is going to be, you know, just absolutely brutal. This would be my 17th session. I've never seen anything even close to this. I know that the members that are even more senior, Senator Collins, Senator Langseth, Senator Olson, they say the same thing. They've never seen anything like this, and it's just it's going to be very tough. And the thing that we have to remember in transportation is that when we make cuts, it's probably somebody's going to hit another pothole that it wasn't might not have been there yesterday. Somebody might have to wait another 15 minutes to catch the bus. Those are the types of inconveniences that our committee and the people who access the transportation end of it potentially will see. But the cuts that are made in other portions of the budget mean that people don't get health care. They may not be able to eat. They may be thrown out on the street. So when we go through our budget, I think we should feel pretty fortunate where we're at. I think that we were plenty lucky last year to pass our funding bill when we did. Because if we hadn't these decreases that the department would see and other agencies would be double-digit percentages instead of just maybe 5 or 8 or 9% reductions. So I think we're pretty lucky here. And like I said, transportation is vitally important, but, you know, we're not putting food on people's table or roofs over their heads. So. With that, I'm going to adjourn the committee with my phantom gavel.